Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This is an hour of learning in our Yeshiva Shalmaila, learning, Hashkafa. This week we're going to have both. We're going to be speaking as a second and last in a series of mental health and halacha. We will have from Lakewood, New Jersey, Rabbi Binyamin Babad, who runs a large mental health organization. He'll be speaking to us about some of the practical applications. We will have from Yerushalayim, Agoyin Rabbi Asher Weiss, the Minchas Usher. He'll be speaking about OCD in Halacha, Pikuach Nefesh. We will speak a little bit about, you know, mental health and Pikuach Nefesh. We will have from Elizabeth, New Jersey, Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Schwartz, a professional in this field, as well as a Rav, who has a shul, a large following. From Scranton, Pennsylvania, Dr. Meshulam Epstein, speaking about OCD. We will have, going back to New Jersey, we will have the famous Shadchan, Yisrael Freddie Friedman. He will be speaking about mental health and shidduchim, his experience and how to deal with those situations, what to disclose, when to disclose it, a mixture of both hashkaf, again, and what he's accepted, halacha, what he was makabel. And then lastly, we will have the parent of a child, a young woman who was divorced because there was no disclosure of mental health illness in a shidduch. So we will be speaking about, again, halacha, hashkafa, our hour of learning. Before we begin, go to our wonderful guest, I would like to say a thought on the parsha. These weeks, this is the last week that talks about Avram. Avram Zakein Ba Bayamim. And Chazal say, the Gemara says, what was the currency of Avram? Matbeya shel Avram Avinu was Zakein Uzkena Mitzad Echad Ubachar Upsula Mitzad Acher. So I have a question. Avram Avinu had his first child, the father of Klal Yisrael, when he was 99 years old. Now, we understand the Rabbeinu Shalom wanted to make a nest. When somebody doesn't have a child for 20 years and they have a child, they make a big kiddush with hot kiddush. They roll out 10 herrings, chalent, kishka, yapchik, the works. Why did 99 years old? I mean, isn't that stretching it? Avraham Avinu waits till he's 99. Sarah, she's 89. So let me propose a svara. And I saw this by Reb Tzadik. I was Mechaven Baruch Hashem, a beautiful Torah min Hashemayim that I saw by Reb Tzadik of Lublin. But think of this. What's the message? Do you know when people get older, how they sort of said, you know, that's it, I'm finished, I'm done, I can't learn a new job. It's, you know, I was trained in accounting I was the best buggy whip manufacturer, and guess what? They're out of business, buggy whip manufacturers. The world is changing. I can't learn a new business. My marriage, it got stale. To turn over a new leaf, come on, we can't. That one I never got along with. He's the black sheep in the family. Turn over a new leaf, come on, that's not realistic. Getting along with some parent or in-law, whatever the case may be, how often do we always often feel, that's it, it's Yish, we're stuck. So what does the Torah say? If Avraham Avinu hadn't had Yitzchak when he was 99, he would have disappeared from history. Who would have heard of Avraham Avinu? The father of all the religion, most of the religions of the world, Av HaMoyin Gayim, that's what Chazal call him, father of the world, of Hamoyin Gayim, many nations, he would have disappeared. We wouldn't have heard of him. At 99, Avram becomes who Avram is. I think there's a powerful message. We say, Masa Yagiyu Maisei Lamaisei Avoisai. When are we going to be like our Avais? Or like the Navi says, Habitu El Avram Avichem. It's a chiyuv for us to look at our grandfather Avram. So what is it telling us? Us too, we are the grandchildren. We're never too old. We're never too old to accomplish what we're supposed to. We're never too old to forgive who we want to forgive or to ask forgiveness. We're never too old to love, to reclaim love. We're never too old to start over. We're never too old, even 99, to achieve your dream. To do anything you want to, it's never too late to be young again. The currency of Avram, when the Gemara says the currency of Avram, the matbeya shel Avram, the Gemara in Baba Kama, Daf Tzadik Zayin, when you say something's his currency, we say the currency of the Chafetz Chaim was Yerushalayim. right? There's a currency of somebody else, of these tzaddikim, there is chesed. The currency of Avram, the Gemara says, was youth, eternal youth, forever young. And we are his grandchildren, habitu el Avram avichem. I had the honor, it's Matzi Shabbos, Shal Shudda, Malava Malka, Minigis to say stories of Erlich Eden. Where I live, Dr. Bernie Land's son-in-law lives on my block, and we fell in love with each other. We met in Shul. He was 40 or 50 years older than me, but right away, I loved him. And he started coming to me Shabbos a lot of times to eat during the day. So he was sitting by the table. He's 90 years old or 92 years old when this happened. And my shver, Zechayin Levracha, was Rosh Yeshiva Beis Shragar of Shul Mendelowitz, was 82. So Dr. Landa turns to my shver and he says, Rabbi Mendelowitz, what do you do now? So my shver is 82, looks at him and he says, I just retired. I was, you know, I ran Beis Shragar for 50 some odd years, 55 years, and I retired. So Dr. Landa, who is a very humble man, looks at my shver and he says, Rabbi Mendelowitz, I studied all of Talmud Bavli, Talmud Yerushalmi. He said, I studied Sifra, Sifri, Taisefta, Medrash Rabba, Zayar, Dalet Chalke, Shulchan Aruch. I'm looking at him. I never heard him say it. Looks. And he says to my shver, and he says, and Rabbi Mendelowitz, I never found any reference to retirement. So here he is at 92 saying, I never found a reference to retirement. Vavram Zakein Baba Yamim. So he told us then, he said, I started Turo when I was 55 years old. He said, I saw that Jewish children needed parnasa, yidin dafim parnasa. He said, I wanted to be mishtatev for Rabbeinu Shalom in giving the mafteich of parnasa to Yiddish kinderlach. And he says, and going to a college is a spiritual holocaust. The children are disappearing. Look at the intermarriage rate. So he founded Turo, and he said, they laughed at me. He decided he was going to open a law school. That was his first school, I guess, Turo Law. And he said, so I applied to New York State, and the last thing they wanted was another Jewish college. So I was rejected. We did all our paperwork. It was perfect. So he said, I decided to apply to Washington to appeal. I guess there's a collegiate appeal process. So he said, I was told that it's a 97% chance of failure. So he said, I did a little homework. And the head of the appellate group in Washington was a fellow from Reading, Pennsylvania, a yid who was married to a non-yid, real friar, you know. He said, now, it so happens, mazel. He says, I was a scholar in residence for many years, off and on. He says, one time, I was asked to be a scholar in residence in Reading, Pennsylvania. So he said, I went to Reading, and I was in a shul. He said, a shul, such amaratzim I never saw in my life. He said, for example, on the luchas, where it says, la'yil l'cha lehim acherim, so he says, the guy, the sculptor, ran out of space. So it said, L'yil l'chalehim. Imagine such hamaratzim. So he says, I called up the rabbi to show. He says, you remember me? I was just scholar resident. He says, I saw that you have a fellow. There's a fellow from Reading. He's a very famous lawyer. He's in Washington. He says, yeah, he davens by us. He says, would you maybe put in a good word, tell him that we're trying hard, we're doing good? He says, look, I don't know if I can help you. He left them very oblique. I don't know if I can help at all. So he says, I went to Washington, and he says, right before our argument was supposed to start, I had to go to the men's room. He says, I'm going to the men's room, and this guy is coming out. He said, and I looked at him, and I said to him in Yiddish, Liza, the goyim villain me harganin. And this person who is married to this mishumit looks at him, and he says, Daigenisht, ich velzenisht lasen. He says, and we got up by the appeal process, and I argued, and everybody, all the judges were against me, and this guy started arguing for me. He says, we won 3-2. He was close to 60 when this happened. So what does that mean? Habitu el Avram Avichem, however stuck we are. So here's something beautiful. Reb Tzadik in Das Seifrim says something beautiful. He says, Avram had 318 right? Vayorach es chanich of Avram Avinu azarat zmeim shloish meyos u'shmoin es yelidei beisai. He says 318 is begimatria yish with the kail. Avram never came to yish. He says 318, the Gemara Nedarim says is begimatria Eliezer. He says, and that's when it says by Moshe, they were about to kill him. The sword was on his throat. And what did he say? Eleke avi be'ezri v'yatzi leini. When you just think, I just ran out of kayach, I can't, it's too hard, a new step in life, he says, that's the message of Avram, that there is no yiyush by a yid. He has an arichas on it. We're going to post it to our site. But I think the message is so powerful. Masa yagiyu maise lamaise avais. Maise avaisai habitu el Avram, wherever we are, at 99, he created Klal Yisrael. I don't think anybody listening to this program is 99. But many of us are certainly stuck in situations. We feel, oh my goodness, we're stuck. What's the message of Avram? You're never too old. The currency of Avram is forever young, everlasting youth. Let's hope we could be zeicha to Masayagi Umaisai. Let's go to our fabulous guest. We have on the phone with us from Lakewood, New Jersey, Rabbi Binyamin Babad, who besides being Ben Achaben from the Menchas Chinuch, and I'm sure is a Talmud Chacham in that case, is also the director of Relief, and his office is in Lakewood. Welcome, Rabbi Babad.
Thank you very much.
Rabbi Babad, going to a therapist, should everybody be doing it? Should select people? Like, is it a sign of health, like going to the gym, or do we have to be more discriminatory than that?
So we're not believers that everybody should be in therapy. That's not our philosophy. The dividing line between somebody who should be in therapy versus not is when something starts affecting your life in a negative way. So the best example, the easiest example I can give is, let's say, for example, somebody has a fear of flying. So if you have a fear of flying and you don't have to fly anywhere, then you can live with it and you don't have to go to therapy. But if your brother's making chasen in Los Angeles and you're not going to go because you're afraid of flying, now you have a problem. So once, let's say, for example, whether it's anxiety, depression, you know, once it starts getting in the way of your functioning, you're not functioning the way you should be functioning, you're not doing the things you should be doing, that's when we recommend that a person should definitely go to therapy.
So you mentioned anxiety, right? So I'm a pretty anxious person. You know, sometimes I tell myself, Ashri Adam Afache Tamid, they must have had me in mind, I guess. But at what point do you say about anxiety, you know, Yemakayim Ashri Adam, and at what time do you say your anxiety is something that needs help?
So again, it's the same getter. You know, people sometimes ask us, if I go to therapy, will I not have any anxiety after that? And I say, you know, that's not the way it's supposed to be. The Rebbeinu Shlomo put anxiety into the Bria for a reason. If you're walking down, you know, a dark alley and there are three, you know, big guys coming the other direction, you're supposed to be anxious to teach you, you know, to tell you to get out of there. Anxiety before a test, anxiety before, you know, doing something major motivates us to do a better job. So anxiety is a normal part of the Bria and it's supposed to be there. However, it's supposed to be that you're in charge of your anxiety, not that your anxiety is in charge of you. So again, once anxiety reaches the point that you're not able to do things that you should be able to do, that's when you need to do something. So if you're a little anxious, everybody's a little anxious, and certainly everybody has reasons to be anxious. But it's once it reaches that level where it's not allowing you to really live a fulfilling life, and it's getting in the way of things that you know you should be doing, that's when you need to take care of it.
So let me give you a metaphorical example. Let's say you had a daughter who was going out. And the boy had suffered from anxiety, had gone to a therapist, and, you know, was under therapy for anxiety. And, you know, would you feel that he should disclose this to the girl? Or would you say, look, you know, 50% of society suffers from anxiety, and, like, what's the big deal? What would be your reaction?
So anxiety is really one of those things that is really so, so prevalent.
How prevalent?
You know, that when we opened up the office in Eretz Yisrael, one of the Gedolim told us that 70% of people suffer from anxiety and the other 30% are on medication.
Okay.
But in all seriousness, I think that the numbers are, if I'm not mistaken, that 25% or maybe more of people will have a panic attack at some point during their life. And then, of course, some of that will develop into a panic disorder. But certainly anxiety or, you know, mild-level anxiety is something that you can't get away from. I mean, people call us up often asking about shidduchim and genetics, and it seems that there is a genetic component to anxiety. But we tell them that when it comes to anxiety, Don't even think about it, because there's not a family in cholesterol that doesn't have, you know, genetic disposition for anxiety. So anxiety is not something that we look at as being something, you know, something to stay away from, if you will, because it's just, it's very, very prevalent. Again, we can't tell you exact numbers, but certainly a large percentage of people are dealing with anxiety at one level or another.
Let me be myself in what you're saying. And I happen to think that the more intelligent somebody is, the more anxious he is, because he becomes more aware of all the things that could go wrong.
Yes,
in other words, less bright. And I'll shtel a raya for it, you know, in the mirror where I learned everything they used to say, mehechatesis. I'll bring you a raya.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the wisest person who ever lived?
Shlaima
HaMelech. And what do we know about Shlaima HaMelech? He had a real sleep disorder. It says, Mitasa yasher l'shlaima, shishim gibayrim savavla megibayre Yisrael, ish harbay al yirechai. He had 60 people, warriors, around his bed, surrounding him every night, because the wisest men who ever lived thought of every possible thing, every possible person who could attack him during sleep. And I think that you talk about it being prevalent. Look at a pasuk like that. I mean, we read the pasuk, we don't understand what we're saying. Mipachad balelos.
Mm-hmm.
It seems he suffered from some type of an anxiety.
But, you know, one of the things that we have discussed with many people in terms of the prevalence of anxiety today is that anxiety is caused by a number of things, but one of the things that causes anxiety is sveikus. Okay, when a person has sveikus. I heard that from a certain Rosh Hashiva. They told me that he once came downstairs and he saw one of his grandchildren sitting by the breakfast table, and he was all fatracht. And he said to him, you know, Tzadkal, what's the matter? So he had like five cereals in front of him. He says, I don't know which ones to choose. Okay? He says, you know, the Rosh Hashiva says, because when I was a kid, there were two choices, Rice Krispies or cornflakes. That was it. The fact that we have so many choices, the fact that we have so much to our, you know, at our disposal, actually adds to anxiety. I once saw a study that the most stressful things in a person's life is divorce, death of a spouse, and building a house. Now, the first two are easy to understand, right? But why building a house? Because there's so many choices. Carpet, tile, what kind of tile should we do? You know, porcelain tile, ceramic tile, marble, and colors. You can go crazy from the choices. And that leads to anxiety.
So let me go back to my question. Your daughter, Malkala, is going out with a wonderful boy, and the boy has gone to a therapist for anxiety. Does he disclose it or not?
So this is probably a question that really should belong to people who have bigger plates than mine.
No, I'm not asking you to paskin. I'm asking you for an opinion as somebody who's
something like that. Something like that, I think, is quite common, and you know, at its, you know, it could be very, very simple and doesn't necessarily need to be discussed, because it could just scare people for no reason. It might be nothing. Of course, if it's something that's more serious, if it is something that you know, significantly impacts the boy's life and will impact the boy's life in marriage, then yeah, then it should be disclosed. But if it's just a bacher who went to a therapist a few times to deal with anxiety 3 years ago, I don't look at that as being such a big deal.
So is it fair to say that garden variety anxiety, and I'm going to add on a caveat, does not have to be disclosed? What about if it required medication at some point?
So that already, you know, goes into a different category. And the general consensus is when you're dealing with somebody who was on medication, that should be disclosed. Different people will tell you different things after the third date, et cetera. But that should be disclosed, because could be an indication of a different level.
Now, I spoke to a physician who works in Chemed,
mm-hmm.
a family physician, and he said, 50% of the prescriptions, and this is mila b'mila, ish mi p'ish, I heard it from myself, 50% of the medications he prescribes are for anxiety, depression, Klonopin, etc. So
mm-hmm.
if it's at such a high level and it needs disclosure, does that mean like one out of every two boys or one out of every two girls is disclosing this?
Well, no. It's, again, when you're talking to a physician like that, and I've actually heard similar numbers, I maybe heard 40%, but certainly not significantly different. But you're talking about, you know, a very, very wide variety of people. You're talking about, you know, adults. You're talking about mothers. You're talking about, you know, older people. So no, you're not talking about, you know, such high numbers, you know, when you're dealing with, you know, young marriage.
Does it increase with age anxiety?
think about it. You know, when you were a bacher, how much did you have to worry about, right? And now that your children are going out, how much do you have to worry about, right? You weren't worried about parnasa, you weren't worried about shidduchim, you weren't worried about, you know, who knows how many other things. And then as you get older, there's a lot more things going on.
Okay. Okay. I mean, I, you know, on the other hand, we have greater tools when we get older, but as somebody who's a professional in the field, I accept what you're saying. Do you find that yeshiva bachrim, the stresses of yeshiva, et cetera, do they have any, you know, do you see any impact on that, on mental health?
Not per se. No, obviously, you know, many of the things that we're dealing with, you're dealing with a younger population, because a lot of these issues, whether it's anxiety or any of the mental health issues that we're dealing with, are going to develop generally in the late teens, early 20s. And that's just across the board. It has nothing to do with from Yidden. That's just the way things work. So, yes, we are seeing a number, you know, a high number of Bachram, but not because they're Bachram, just because that's their age.
How often do you have to get questions about anorexia?
So we actually have a specialized division dealing with eating disorders. Eating disorders are very, very complex, whether it's anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorders. They're very, very complicated. There are many factors that play a role in eating disorder. Eating disorder really, if you think about it, is a symptom of something else that's going on. And what it is that created that eating disorder is what needs to be addressed. So we have somebody here who specializes in eating disorders, and I'm not sure exactly of the numbers, but I think we deal with between 150 and 200 cases a year in eating disorders in the New York area.
Now, how many cases a year do you deal with in general?
It's a smaller percentage, obviously. The general cases is in the thousands.
So how many thousands do you deal with a year?
We deal about 8,000 cases a year, but that's the worldwide number.
Okay, so out of the worldwide number is 200 the entire anorexia? I'm just trying to give it, which would make it around...
No,
sorry.
I'd have to look at the numbers for the New York area to really, because that 200 number is coming from New York area. But I think it's about 5% of what we do is eating disorders, or let's put it this way, is identified eating disorders. There are many times that it takes a while till it comes out that that's what you're dealing with. The thing is with the eating disorder is that although the number might be small, the reason we created this division is because every eating disorder case is like 6 regular cases. First of all, there are many components. You need to deal with adolescent medicine, if you're dealing with an adolescent, which is often the case. You need to deal with a nutritionist, psychiatrist, therapist. There are a lot of people that are involved.
Now, would you say, Rabbi Babad, would you say that eating disorders are something that do have to be disclosed in Shidduchim?
Eating disorders is a serious thing, yeah. Eating disorders is a serious thing, and not disclosing. You know, we always tell people that getting them to the chuppah is not the goal. You know, getting them married is not the goal. Keeping them married is the goal.
Right.
So, you know, not disclosing something that's, you know, that's serious and can impact the marriage is a very big mistake.
What can we do as parents? And I say as parents because once you become a parent, it becomes your primary obligation. But it could be as siblings, it could be as spouses, it could be as coworkers, it could be as chavrusas. But let's start with parents because that's the one that I'm a negeya bedavar. What can we do in our upbringing of children, using the old maxim of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, to prevent eating disorders, anxiety, mental health issues? What are the foundations of mental health?
So there are some things that can be prevented and some things that can't. There are certain things that are genetic and you're not really able to prevent them.
And what percentage of the cases you see, what percentage are genetic and what percentage are not genetic?
See, it's hard to answer that with a solid number. As I mentioned before, there's a belief that anxiety is genetic. Mood disorders, bipolar disorder, depression are likely genetic. Schizophrenia is genetic. Whereas personality disorders are not genetic. They're more learned behaviors. So it's hard to say, you know, what's genetic and what's not. But, you know, in terms of prevention, the things that can be prevented, as a parent, when you have an open line of communication with your child, where your child knows that if something is bothering them, that they can come speak to you, they have a place to turn that's safe, that is certainly helpful. It doesn't you know, take care of all the issues. You know, we certainly have to be respectful. That's probably the biggest thing you could do for prevention. But to be able to create an environment where your child knows that if there's something wrong, they can turn to you, certainly would be helpful for prevention and absolutely for early intervention.
So let me talk about that. An open line of communication. given that as humans, and maybe particularly as Bnei Torah, we are particularly judgmental and critical, right? Because again, to be medagdik b'chutei shel yud means we have to constantly be vigilant and watching and careful. How do we, as critical, judgmental parents, how do we maintain that open lines of communication? It sounds like a struggle.
It certainly is a struggle, and I'm no expert in parenting, but it's something that we all have to keep in mind. I mean, if we are judgmental and critical, what are the chances that our children are going to speak to us?
So I just want to go on the record. Do we have Rabbi Babad from Lakewood, leading one of the largest mental health organizations in the world, saying, and I'm going to bring it, we're going to transcribe this, that to have healthy children, and I imagine that goes to spouses and other relationship as well, we have to have an open line of communication, and the only way, and what will severely damage open lines of communication are judgmentalism and criticism.
So again, I'm far from an expert, and this is one man's...
Do I see a retreat? Do I hear a retreat here or not?
No, not a retreat, just a caveat, a disclaimer, if you will. I'm an observer, right? I see a lot of things. We're dealing with, like I said before, thousands and thousands of cases. Our caseload last year was over 12,500 people. So by seeing what happens in situations, so that's where I form my opinions, but my opinions are just my opinions. But listen, I think most people would agree that that being overly critical is detrimental. Being too judgmental is detrimental. We know that
I have a raya from a chazal to you.
Oh, go ahead.
It says Bitchila Allah Marshava Libra Bemidis Hadin. Rosh Ein Eilam Eskayim, Shitev Imimidis Rachmim. Din means judgment, right?
Right.
The Rabbeinu Shalom saw that the world is not Neskayim with judgment. If we judge, if he judges, if Kaviyachal judges, and we are Mahu Avata, if we judge, Rosh Ein Eilam Eskayim. Eilam means your family, it means the people you love, it means your community. If we want to be Einim Eskayim, we have to do B'midas Hadin. You want it to be Meskayim, it has to be B'midas Arachbim. I have a raya to what you're saying.
Yeah, there you go.
So, Rabbi Bad, let me go back to my questions. What do you do for the Lakewood community?
So, I think what we do for the Lakewood community is, again, what we do for all the communities that we're in. We give an opportunity for people who are often silently struggling and maybe suffering from a variety of emotional mental health issues, a place where they can turn, speak to somebody who understands what they're dealing with, who can help them figure out what's going on, and most importantly, get them to the right source of help. One of the things that we are very, very careful of is that we don't play doctor. We know that we're not the people who can help them, but we're the people who can help them find the people who can help them. And that service is a fabulous service, because without it, how do you find a quality mental health professional? How do you find somebody that has the clinical background and experience and training to deal with whatever it is you're dealing with? How do you find somebody who's going to match with you on a personal level, on a hashkafa level? It's not like you just open the phone book and pick out a name. And this is the work that we do, and the success, Baruch Hashem, has been tremendous.
So, Rabbi Babad, I know that Rabbi Horowitz has been in our program, and he said that most of the children who've committed suicide have been molested. Would you agree that the damage of molestation is so powerful, and does therapy help for it?
So the damage of molestation is very, very, very terrible, and it's long-lasting. Certainly there are statistics that you can argue maybe a little with, but I don't think you can argue a lot with in terms of children that go off the derech, specifically girls that go off the derech. The numbers of molestation cases are very, very high.
What are those statistics? Can you share this with them?
Some people will say 100%. If you're talking about a girl who comes from a healthy family, not a dysfunctional family. Dysfunction, everything, that changes the equation. But if you're talking about a girl that came from a healthy family, there are people who will say 100%. I wouldn't say 100%, but I would probably say in the high 90s.
The children, girls who go off the derech, is because there's been some type of a molestation in their background.
It's very often the case. Again, from a healthy family.
So you're saying that when we read in the news about Harvey Weinstein, it's not isolated to the world at large. We have similar issues. When you see a girl off the derech, you know, some type of a religious, I shouldn't say religious, some type of a masquerading religious Harvey Weinstein has gotten their hands on her. And the high 90 percentile, you're saying?
That's what it seems to us. And unfortunately, sometimes it's people who are closer than you know, people from outside. Sometimes it's within the family, and that's particularly damaging. But it is something that unfortunately we do see. And we are, you know, we have our radar open for that when certain things are described to us. It usually takes quite a while for it to come, you know, to come to the surface. But eventually, that's what we usually find out.
And are you able to help? Has Relief been able to help these people?
So, Baruch Hashem, there are some really excellent clinicians out there, people who are really well trained, who have the right attitudes, have a heart in terms of being able to help people and wanting to help people. And Baruch Hashem, we've seen tremendous help. One of the nice stories that come to mind, there was a young woman who came to us. I think she was like 18 or 19 years old, and she had been abused by a family member, and her family was not supportive. They didn't want to hear from it, and she needed help. And Baruch Hashem, we had some funding available to be able to help her because she didn't have, you know, the money to do it on her own. We sent her to a therapist, and Baruch Hashem, I'm glad to report a few years later that not only she married and has her own family, but she now works for an organization that helps girls, you know, who went through similar traumas.
Rabbi Baba, talk about the damage that divorce does. Can it be through good parenting, therapy, etc.? Is there damage, and can it be avoided? Can it be helped?
So again, divorce is a complicated topic because there are so many different situations. There are situations where, unfortunately, you know, the divorce is called for, and the divorce might even be better. You know, the Baruch Shalem gave the option of a get, because sometimes that's what needs to be done. So you can't paint with a broad brush and say, you know, divorce is always going to be bad and there's always going to be damage. However, you know, when the parents are fighting each other and it's a bitter divorce and the children are caught in the middle and are used as pawns, then there's no question that there's significant damage.
And can therapy reverse that?
So I think that therapy can be very, very helpful in many, many situations. Again, one of the things we have found is that when you have a combination of somebody who wants help and then you match them up with somebody who's, you know, trained and skilled to be able to give that help, your chances of success are very high, and no matter what you're dealing with.
Rabbi Babad, it's been an honor to have you on with us. Rabbi Shalom should give you the kayach to continue to be one of those who are mezakia rabbim and one of those who love Klal Yisrael and do taivis for Klal Yisrael. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
Kol tov, bye-bye.
So from Eretz Yisrael, we have Harav Hagaon, Rabbi Asher Weiss, the Baal Mechaber, Minchas Usher, the eponymously named Kol. Let's hear what he has to say about OCD.
To ask the Rav, I know you wrote a tshuva about OCD in Halacha. And could you give us a little bit as the Rav of Shari Tzedek Hospital and somebody who has a big department that works with nervous disorders, a big area to work with psychology and other mental disorders, what is your been experience and what type of halachas have you had to paskin in this? And give us a little bit of your conclusions.
Regarding OCD, this is something that is very, very common and very prevalent in our society. And sometimes I am asked that people that are suffering from OCD and they have tremendous difficulty in davening properly. And by nature of this illness, it is compulsive, it is obsessive, and sometimes people are tormented in the way they daven or bench. So the tshuva you mentioned in Minchas Osher is one of the last tshuvas in the second volume of Minchas Osher, deals with the Talmud Chochem, that feels that he can't even say Shem Hashem properly. And he spends many hours a day just trying to bench, to say Krishna, to daven. And the psak I gave him basically was that try to daven once, do your best, and never go over either a Shem or a Baruch or a Posek twice. And knowing that the treatment of OCD necessitates letting these people get out of their tension and their stress, even if you wouldn't be properly mekayim these mitzvahs, our psak would be, do the best you can and move on, because that is the only chance to help these people in their healing process and to enable them in the future to be mekayim the mitzvahs b'shleimus. My tshuva to the many young people that are tormented by OCD and they feel that they can't daven properly and they can't bench properly. So it is not only that my psak is do your best and move on because you need to get into a healing process. Far beyond that, I think when they do their best, they are mekayim mitzvahs tfilo. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu shomea tfilas kol peh. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu shomea tfilas kol peh, that includes people that cannot really pronounce the words as they should. They are included in Ki'atu Shomea Tfilas Kol Peh. And because of the unique status of these two mitzvahs, I think every other Yisrael could be mekayim these mitzvahs and to have the privilege to be zeichet to what comes along with these mitzvahs.
There's some sefer to say, you only have to clean one time, you're not allowed to look back, and that's it, because we're going to be Saimach and Chsam Seifer, Chsitz is a Drabban, and it's almost impossible to figure a case where it would be a Daraisa. And basically, what's be Saimach and Chsam Seifer, because we want you to get better?
We definitely could say that, but once again, I assume that after one time, there is no Chsitz. I mean, the body of an OCD patient is no different than the body of any other person. And therefore, once is enough, but we need to find ways to calm these people and to try to ease them along the way to heal, and that is the way.
We have on the phone with us a Mr. Schwartz, who has a shidduch story that I think we could learn a lot from, and rather than me telling the story, let me have Mr. Schwartz tell the story. Welcome, Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you. I want to share this because it's a very important story for people to learn from, not from, I would say, my mistake, but my experience. I think many times we think we can hide things, but we don't realize that there is a limited amount of time that we can hide that. I have a child who got married, and we, for some reason, the mental illness of the other party, the spouse, was hidden. Now, sometimes it is easier to hide a mental illness than it is a physical illness, but sometimes it isn't. For example, diabetes is something that many people try to hide. But again, you know, there are mental illnesses which may be more easy to hide than certain physical illnesses. Part of the problem is the way we look at mental illness to begin with. The way insurance companies pay for their benefits, the comfort in people getting healed, the comfort of people being able to share it. Now, when you do your research for a shidduch, I don't like using the word research, but when you ask people what they can say about the other person, it is very, very common for people to ask, is there any mental illness in the family? And if you want to do a favor for everybody involved, you would come out and say, yes, this is what you should know. People many times don't like to put me down as references because I say it the way it is. And if there is mental illness, I think, or any illness, I think it's important to let people know. I have, in my case, the mental illness was masked until right after the chuppah. And the details are not that important. Only the fact is that my child realized it immediately after the chuppah.
How did he realize it?
In his immediate conversation and understanding how she viewed marriage and why she viewed it. She, at that point, felt that she... That
how
she
many times had they gone out? Mr. Jones, how many times had they gone out?
More than a dozen.
And he saw nothing?
No, he just thought it was shyness. He really didn't pick up too much. He did question it. But he, you know, even after he was engaged, he was told that this is, you know, you're getting cold feet, and, you know, people like to throw things under the carpet.
Now, what and, should have, what would you tell a parent, what should have he noticed that an intelligent parent should have said, hey, don't give me, I need to check this out more. Like, give me an, give us an example. Like, there's always the people, that. You know, Rabbi Schwartz, Mr. Schwartz, there's always people who say, bah, 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 it's a, and look, I employ a lot of people. Don't throw excuses at me if we're going over a cliff, right? So, like, what are some of the things that you say, hey, if you have a child who's dating and somebody says, hey, the boy or the girl is X, you should not take, like, just some bland, warm, rewarmed excuse, but your hackle should go up and you should look at it carefully.
I think you have to, first of all, both parties have to realize that you're not doing anybody a favor by not letting everybody know what's going on. You're hurting both both parties involved and their families directly and extended families. You don't realize that the chances of them doing a shidduch after this is greatly, greatly minimized. There are many mental illnesses that can be addressed. They can live happily ever after marriage. And I think if the person knows about it, the chances of that happening are much greater. On the other hand, if a parent suspects or if the child suspects that there's something wrong, they have to be very, very cautious and take the steps to find out what's going on.
So it's after the chuppah, and your son realized that the girl's behaving differently, or she was just honest with him post chuppah.
It was a daughter.
Oh, I'm sorry, your daughter. So was it? Did she just say, "Hey, he admitted it to me," or he just started going off the farm?
No. When some questions were asked, his response was, "Well, I don't think that's what a marriage is all about." And
okay.
She walked out and said, "Is something wrong? I suspected this was wrong." And interestingly enough, she pulled both my wife and I aside and said, "There's something terribly wrong. It wasn't only cold feet. This young man is not well."
And what did he have in retrospect?
In retrospect, you were right.
I don't mean that. Was it bipolar, schizophrenia, like one of these major diseases?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely major. But a lot of these things could be masked, either with medication or people are trained how to hide them.
And as to what happened with your daughter? Did she stay with him?
No, not at all. The marriage was not consummated. They had to make a decision, and she made it right then. Do we send everybody home, or do we have a party?
And what did you do?
She went to the party. All her friends were there. And Baruch Hashem, she remarried a year and a half later, and nobody held it against her.
And did the boy remarry?
No. And I met with him afterwards, together with his parents, and I made it very, very clear that his condition could be helped. But the only way he'll get help is if he brings it to the table.
So did he, at afterwards, now going out, does he disclose it?
I don't think he has gone out yet. I think he's gone through the process of the hurt that he went through and partially blaming the people who advised him to hide it.
But you say it doesn't help?
This is a bigger problem of the way we view mental illness.
In the respect of
how we view it, you know, we call somebody with mental illness a meshuggah. What does that word mean?
That's a terrible, terrible word. That's a terrible, terrible word.
Right? The person is not well. We have to have rachmanis on him. And just like when you go raise money for somebody who needs special treatment that's not covered by insurance, the same thing should be done for mental illness. But instead, we just wipe it off and we say, you know, why is it that we have a tremendous amount of rachmanis, somebody who's being walked around on a wheelchair, but somebody's walking around in a zombie state, you just make fun of him. It's the same person. HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings different forms of illnesses. And mental illness is much, much more difficult to deal with than a physical one. Because the form of cure and what a person has to go through is much more difficult. When you're dealing with the brain, the least, you know, again, there are emotions involved, there's a heart, there's different things, but it's primarily the brain. And it's the most difficult part of the body to really understand.
And it's interesting that your daughter was courageous enough to do something about this and not just, you know, be swept with the momentum, no?
I'll give my wife the credit for that.
Well, Mr. Schwartz, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, always.
Okay.
And from New Jersey, here's Rabbi Dr. Jonathan Schwartz, an expert, a professional in OCD, and he's going to be speaking about OCD both from a halacha, a hashkafa, and from a professional opinion. This is really a fascinating conversation. Let's hear what Rabbi Schwartz has to say.
From my perspective, it often comes from a misunderstanding, mistaken beliefs. That's the model I work from, where people walk around with a mistaken belief for whatever reason. It could be something that they heard and they only paid attention to half the shiur. It could be something that they developed within their minds. It could be, for whatever reason, it's irrelevant from where it comes from. It's more relevant to me as a therapist to help the person understand you are thinking these errant thoughts, and as a result, it's causing you to have doubt, and as a result, you are scared, and as a result, you're going to extremes that aren't reasonable. And if it's religious based, you're turning it into a religious halachic matter, and that's a problem, whether it's in davening, or it's in kashrus, or it's in taras hamishpach, or it's in Pesach and Pesach cleaning. Whatever it is, your goal is to be poshet all shilas of doubt. You want to get rid of any sort of concern, because what you're really going after is this major fear you have. And in most cases that I've worked with that are scrupulosity-based, they're often based in some variation of, I don't want the Ribbono Shel Olam to get angry at me, I don't want to be punished, I don't want to go to Gehenna, etc. We all don't want to go to Gehenna, but it's not the totality of why we do Torah and Mitzvahs. We all don't want to do the wrong thing, but it's not the totality of how we engage in what we do. And as a result, we are able to put it into a context and live in a more healthy environment and live within the boundaries of the halacha that also has room for sfeikos and tells us what we're supposed to do when we have a sfeik. And somebody who's so overwhelmed with that thought and that concern, so concerned about it, he or she will wind up rushing and running to try to do whatever he or she can to get out of the doubt. And sometimes they wind up distorting the halacha as a result.
So is it curable? Or is it more like alcoholism where you just have to sort of avoid it?
Baruch Hashem, I like to believe without a doubt that I've had some wonderful success. But the word cure is a very exciting word. To me, the definition of cure is that something is not working right now and something can work down the road. And if I learn certain steps, then I can make it work. A person who has OCD is a person whose life is disordered. Doesn't mean he or she will never have the thought again. If your goal is to never have an obsessional thought, then that's ridiculous. The person, every single one of us have obsessional thoughts. But when I think of a cure and success in treatment of OCD, what I want to do is make sure that a person is working with me or any one of these wonderful, wonderful therapists that we have who really do spend a tremendous amount of time researching and understanding obsessive-compulsive disorder and working with the members of our community who may be suffering this way. What we want to do is help them understand where they're obsessing, what it's causing them to do, and help them understand and learn ways to live a completely normal life and place these thoughts in a context where they're able to say, that's an obsessive thought, I don't have to pay attention to that. What I need to do is pay attention to reality, halacha, halachic-based Judaism.
We have, from Scranton, Pennsylvania, a medical professional who has devoted his career substantially to the issue of those who are unable to control their impulses, Meshulam Epstein. Welcome, Meshulam, and we look forward to speaking to you on this topic. Thank you for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure. Great to be on your program.
So give us a little bit of insight. How do we deal those? How would you talk to somebody who is struggling with this phenomenon?
So the gold standard of treatment for OCD is called exposure and response prevention, and that basically means that the person is guided to expose themselves to whatever it is that they're afraid of, and in this case, it's fear of Gehenna, a fear of being over a halacha, and not doing what they would normally do in response to that fear. So it would be repeating something, doing it over again, or asking a lot of questions is also a compulsion. So so that is really what the gold standard of treatment for OCD is. I'd like to say something that I think is critical in understanding this in as it relates to halacha. The people who suffer from OCD, the most painful element or the thing that keeps them doing their compulsions is their inability to tolerate uncertainty. Maybe this happened, maybe this is treif, maybe my tefillin are in the wrong place, maybe I made a nether, maybe I damaged somebody. And in my practice, probably 95% of the OCD patients that I treat are people who suffer from halacha OCD. So we have to be very careful when we go to a Rav, because what happens is if they get reassurance from a Rav, we may be unwittingly feeding into their OCD by providing reassurance from a Rav. And what happens is every time now when they have a question, they're going to have to go to a Rav to get reassurance.
Is your point that you would go to the Rav to basically for the really the more radical part of what you want, but basically the goal is to allow the therapist, the arbiter of most of the critical decisions?
Yeah, he can be, because we can look around and see what people do.
Because basically most of what he's concerned about really is things that are really very simple, and any logical therapist, these are the things that your average person struggles with, so he's very equipped to make most of these decisions. That's your
absolutely
point.
Anyone, it's just a regular life thing, and we know as therapists that most of these questions, most of them, not all, don't fall even into the realm
of what
of,
you would regularly require a Rav for. So you would really
yeah.
need a Rav for very, very few issues. And the therapist, if he's a Ben Taira, is really equipped to make the great majority of the decisions of what a regular
right.
OCD person would.
And
would
sometimes
start
asking
with.
A Rav really could provide more certainty for the person, which is the worst thing for an OCD person. What we're trying to do is condition him through these behavioral exercises to accept more uncertainty.
Which is really the realm of most of us live in, is the world
exactly,
of uncertainty.
That is part of my spiel. Exactly, exactly. I say, your reality is no different than anyone else's. You just unfortunately suffer from anxiety that constantly reminds you of that small chance of something going wrong. But the reality is, we all live in the same world, and everyone lives with uncertainty, whether it's halachic uncertainty, physical health uncertainty. You know, there's many, many decisions in life that we don't get to know how great they were. Sometimes we don't get to know until later in life, and sometimes we never get to know. So really, the critical issue is, and many of my clients have told me that that's what's made the difference for them, is that we really push the acceptance of uncertainty, which is ubiquitous. Everyone has to live with it. It's part of life. So uncertainty is a part of our halachic lives. There's no way to avoid it. And this is what we want our clients to learn, instead of their compulsions being a way of running away from uncertainty.
We have on the phone with us, from Lakewood, New Jersey, Rabbi Yisrael Freddie Friedman, a Talmud of Edison, Brisk, and Lakewood, one of the famous shadchanim in the world. And I say that with the greatest respect, because we know that it says, the Gemara says, what does Kav Yochel do? Now it says he's Isaac and Shaduchim. That's what the Rabbi Nisholem does. So it's a truly, somebody says you have the same business line as the Rabbi Nisholem. I think that's a very admirable thing. Welcome, Rabbi Friedman.
Thank you, and I appreciate it, even though this is short notice.
Rabbi Friedman, you know, as a shadchan, you've probably come across, and this is the extreme, but you know, you always take a, make a point by going to the extreme. People who, you know, got divorced within the first week of Sheva Brachas.
Yeah.
And that almost, for the most part, that means that there's some mental health issues involved. And I had by me a guest on, just literally the last few days of Yom Tif, and she said that she had a friend who, the boy was on drugs, they didn't tell her, on, you know, mind-altering drugs, and their first year he went away for Pesach, he decided he's not taking his drugs anymore. And he gave her two black eyes, I mean, he became crazy. And they got divorced, and she's, and this, it's 35 years later, the girl never remarried. Unfortunately, some people get scarred and they never, right? And to me, if somebody had asked about that boy and knew about him and didn't disclose that he's on mind-altering drugs, and I'm not talking about somebody who had some depression or who was anxiety, but I'm talking, and didn't disclose it, that whoever didn't disclose that is, to me, karev to a reitzeach. Not only of this girl, but all the children she could have had. What has been your experience about people, and you deal with this on a daily basis, covering up? Like, do you say honesty is more the norm? Are these the exceptions? Give us a feel for what, I'm sure you've spoken to Rabbanim and Gedolim, and you have a big hashkaf about it. Tell us what your hashkaf is.
I mean, I'll be honest with you, with mental illness, I've never been able to wrap my head around it. When I first started doing Shidduchim, a close friend of mine, you know, a mentor of mine, was a lady. She's, you know, probably 35, 40 years my senior, and she'd been doing Shidduchim for many years, called me up about a certain boy who suffered from bipolar. But she said, he's such a great guy, he's so normal, and if he's medicated, it's not a problem. And he's gotten clearance from his therapist and his, you know, psychotherapist and whatnot. And if I have, you know, a Shidduch for him. And the truth is that I had just literally had just met a girl who came from a family that was, you know, let's say she was at a little bit of a disadvantage in Shidduchim. Not a little, but a lot of a disadvantage in Shidduchim. And I thought this would be a tsugapast, a Shidduch. But I said to the boy's parents, I said, I'm not going to go into this unless he discloses it after the first date. And they said, you know, third date, fourth date, I had asked my people. My people said, you have to disclose something of this graph. You know, there are certain issues that maybe it's, you know, some Rabbanim would, you know, say that they would best to wait 3 days, 4 days. But this was an issue that I didn't feel like that they should get even. It's such a major issue that they're going to even, like, it's not going to help that they're emotionally involved. In fact, it's just going to hurt them, both sides. And who knows, you know, this guy's bipolar, what could happen? So I said, let's just, you know, after the first date, he should, you know, disclose it with his, you know, with his therapist, with his this, with his doctors. And that's exactly what happened. On the second date, he brought her to his therapist, and she had, she basically, you know, reassured the girl that he's 100% fine, and he, you know, as long as he takes his medication, and she explained to him what bipolar is and the chemical imbalance of it and blah, 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 blah. So the mice, they ended up getting married, and they were basically divorced before the end of Sheva Brachos, you know? So I had felt a tremendous amount of guilt on my end. So my policy has always been since then, you know, if somebody has mental illness, I just would rather not be the, you know, shotgun, only because I just don't know it and I can't take a chryas for it. And there are special shotgunim that deal exclusively with this, but they have so much more experience dealing with mental illness and knowing what to match up. I really don't know what to match. How do you match up someone with bipolar? I don't know what's a good shidduch for them, you know? I can't wrap my head around it. That was the one experience that I had where I knew about mental illness and it was a disaster. So I won't go near there anymore. As far as like physical illness or, you know, different things that come up, you know, diabetes and all. And, you know, like I have so many stories where I have, you know, I never even heard of these illnesses, you know, like, you know, BGT and MGT, like all types of, you know, rear illnesses that came up in Shidduchim. And each one was a different parsha on its own. You know, I have some beautiful stories if you have time. But
on the contrary, share a story with us.
So I had a story with someone who had, you know, who she was a girl that was also from out of town, and her father was a Rebbe, and you know, she was a very tall girl, and she there weren't that many guys in my repertoire that I had for this girl, you know. The guy had to be over 6'5", he had to be, you know, out of town is already a disadvantage for the same reason, by the way. Shidduch crisis is cruel, so it takes no prisoners, and out of town suddenly becomes a disadvantage. Why should an out-of-towner be at any disadvantage to New Yorker? Because why not? I have plenty of New Yorkers. Why should I go out of town? You understand? Again, that's the shidduch crisis that, you know, that we spoke about, is that ultimately anybody who's, you know, at any sort of disadvantage suddenly goes down to the bottom of the pool because there's just not enough to go around. They go so far down the bottom of the pool because, you know, if there's a 1.5 to 1 ratio, and suddenly a girl, add in the thing that a girl's, you know, comes from a family that has no money and is out of town and is too tall, this and that, suddenly there's a major, major disadvantage, you know, which doesn't make sense, but that's just the way it is. And ultimately, I found a guy who, he came to my office one day, he says, yeah, I'm looking for a girl, his father's a Rebbe, who's out of towner, who's very tall, he's attracted to someone tall. And I was like, okay, I went into my system, look, and literally like two names popped up, and this was one of the names, this girl, you know. So I set him up with her. I sent him to, you know, the place that she lived. It was like on the West Coast, and she, you know, he went there, she came here. They went out like 4 times, and after the 4th date, the girl disclosed that she has a very, very rare form, something that literally it's like 1 in a million, and ultimately there's not enough data in the research that they've done with this illness. Basically, most of the people that have it die in infancy. Okay, it's a birth defect that most of the people that are born, they die in infancy. But the 20% that survive usually have no problem, you know, for the rest of their lives. The only question is in pregnancy, if this could exacerbate the problem. That was the issue. You understand? And they had gone to their neurologist, and the neurologist had told them, you know, he doesn't think it's an issue, and, you know, they had their, what's it called again? Ultimately, the boy who was dating his girl, you know, he went to his parents said, listen, what do you need this for, you know? There's a million fish in the sea. Why do you need to go out with a girl who might be a problem? This or that. So they broke off the shidduch after 4 times. Anyway, so a couple months later, the father called me crying. He says, listen, my daughter, you know, she hasn't been able to get a date. People don't even know about the issue, and she's having a hard time, you know? And, like, this guy, like, she doesn't stop thinking about this guy, and it's like it's totally beyond her control. What do you say? So I said to her, listen, this guy was interested in marrying your daughter. I know that, you know? And the issue was clearly this. I said, so why don't you go around now to every the top neurologist in America, and get opinion letters that will you know, satisfy what you're claiming that your local neurologist is telling you. And he did that. He went on a road trip with his daughter. He went to the University of he went to somewhere in Nevada. He came to Sloan. And just a few neurologists, and he got 3 opinion letters from the top 3 neurologists in America, and 2 of them had said they don't think it's a problem. 1 of them was not sure. He said, listen, I don't have enough data to know if this problem would be exacerbated with pregnancy, whatever. Ultimately, they put the question together. They brought the shiloh to Reb Chaim, and Reb Chaim, and I had the boy, because I went down to the boy and his parents, and I said, listen, at the end of the day, the girl went around. She went around on a 2-week road trip, meeting with neurologists. They were reviewing her MRI. At least go into Reb Chaim and present the shiloh, because who else are you going to go to that has Ruach HaKodesh that could make a decision like that? And he brought the shiloh into Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim looked at the papers and all the documentation, and he said, Ein Shum Chash Sakana. That was his psak. And that's it. And they got married. Baruch Hashem, they got married. And they had kids, and they never had a problem with pregnancy. The Baruch Hashem was a happy ending. But ultimately, it's a story about perseverance of a father who loves his daughter, who will do anything to, you know, to make it happen for her. I mean, you know, it's a beautiful story. Unfortunately, a lot of times it doesn't have a happy ending like this. But that's a story for people that are struggling with some sort of, you know, physical or, you know,
So the message is get the data, you're saying, so that if you need it, you could present it.
Yeah.
The data. So Rabbi Friedman, so are you a believer then in full disclosure of physical or mental issues, mental health issues?
1,000,000%. There's no point of not disclosing. I mean, you know, we've all heard of stories that people who didn't disclose physical ailments ended up divorced because of it, because it's the complete total. And you know that your spouse is going to find out, right? So it's just, medical records are there. So
now, what do you feel about... Rabbi Friedman, what do you feel about like Lashon Hara? You know, people are worried. Oh, it's Lashon Hara. You know, my son was going out and she was read a girl and whoever we called, my wife said she just felt it was. So she called her. Yeah, she was very good. And then a friend of hers said, look, find out why she missed 4 months in school, you know, her last year in school. So my wife found out, finally, by this, that the girl was anorexic, which is, fine, but it's dealable. It says, but people felt no Lashon Hara to disclose that. What is your, tell us the Das Torah that you've accepted, I shouldn't say Das Torah because that's political, but the Psakim that you've received and that you use and that you would ask somebody, what's Lashon Hara and what's not?
It's interesting. In 11 years of being a shadchan, I've never, ever met a girl that had a documented case of anorexia, because anytime she's totally anorexic, they always have a carrot, you know? No, it was a high school, it was a kufa, anxiety. She loves food, you know, even, you know, so there's always like that's almost the worst label to have in Judaism is anorexia. And that's why people seemingly to me, it looks like people are trying to hide it because I don't blame them because, you know, you're in a very, very tricky position when it comes to these types of disclosures, because it could mean it like a death sentence in Judaism. If a girl gets labeled as someone who has an eating disorder, and again, a lot of times people don't know the facts. But you know, girl, she left school for 4 months. Maybe she was anorexic. Maybe she wasn't. Maybe she was dealing with a different issue. A lot of times people speculate, and it's hard to be the one that takes the cries. And again, of course, you know, I'm not a rav. I never claimed to be a rav. I don't know Hilchos Lashon Hara at all, so I can't tell you the halachic ramifications of it. It's not my area of expertise. But I could tell you that, you know, you have to think before you talk also. And also, you have to be able to have – listen, let's put it this way. If your sister was in Shidduchim, okay, and your friend you thought had a mental illness, would you telling your sister, would that be Lashon Hara? No, right? That's someone you care for, and that's your own speculative thing, and you know you could trust them and that it's not going to go further. And you say, listen, this guy rubs me the wrong way. Don't go out with him. Is that Lashon Hara? I mean, you know, so you always have to find someone in Shidduchim that's closer to you than it is to them to find out the real bottom line story, you know? It doesn't have to necessarily be, obviously, a sibling.
But Rabbi Friedman, my question is that we're dealing with two counter things. We have on one hand Lashon Hara. On the other hand is a concept of Loisame Del Dam Riecha. Like, you know, Rav Oldenburg writes in a psak, he was asked by somebody,
But again, who really knows the facts when it comes to...
The person who does I'm talking if you do know the facts, or you have, you have reasonable weight, you know, you have rias, whatever. I mean, somebody's anorexic, it's sort of visible to the eye. It's something that's nicaraline, right, for the most part. So my point is, how do you, and you have to deal with this on a daily basis, how do you separate the Isser of Leisame Del Dam Riecha with the Isser of Lashon Hara, the two countervailing, is this something that you say, look, it's not my area of expertise, which I accept too?
It's for sure not my area of expertise, but I'm just thinking as a logical person, Leisame Del Dam Riecha seems to be a much bigger issue than Lashon Hara, right?
Right, so, I would agree with that.
Just from a logistical perspective, obviously, if you're putting someone in a position where they're going to ruin their lives, with their whole, first of all, it's probably not Lashon Hara. Again, I don't know the whole Lashon Hara, but if you're going to ruin somebody's life by not, by,
no,
by,
it's certainly it would certainly be Latayelis, yes.
Right. Okay. So then that's not a question.
So would you say that in your experience, do people disclose what they should disclose? And I'm not talking about the individuals. I'm talking about when asked for information, do you find that Lashon Hara trumps Lysamed Aldam Riecha for the most part?
Again, I think people are honest with their friends. You know, there's loyalty, you know. Lashon Hara is, you know, it's obviously a major issue. But when it comes to Shidduchim, if you have a real friend, you'll get down to the bottom of it, you know. And they'll tell you the Lashon Hara, if it's even considered Lashon Hara, which I don't think it is.
It's not Lashon Hara.
Right. So usually you'll find, in a Shidduch, you'll find someone that likes you better than, you know, that's closer to you than to them, that will give you the information that you need. So
right.
That's how people do research. You know, when you look at someone's references, they're just points of references. You know, that's where you find out where, you know, who their friends are, so you can get to their friends' friends and find out the truth. You know? So I look at all these resumes. It's just fluff, you know. You got to find out from your references, not from their references. But that's just, you know, regular. That's the logical perspective. I think that's just the, you know, again, I'm not a Rav and I'm not a, you know, any halachic authority whatsoever to make any of these decisions. But, you know, I think that's just, you know,
so Rabbi Friedman,
the basic logic.
There's a stigma if a poor boy went to a psychologist, if a girl went to a psychologist, if the parents, anything, like it's the most covered up thing, you know, they have back entrances. Now, the world where I come from, if you didn't go to a psychologist, it means you probably work for the post office. It means you have no struggles. You don't have any stress in your life, which means your job is, or whatever you're doing, is not a stressful area, which means you probably, your head is as flat as an aircraft carrier. You have no, it just means you're a bland person who has never pushed, never stressed, never tried. I mean, almost every successful executive I know has coaches, psychologists working to keep them in, just like a physical coach, really running at all cylinders hitting. I mean, getting the noise out of their head, getting conflict out of their head so that their focus could be like laser focus. And yet in the Haredi community, it's like this, if you're a psychologist, it's like chere, shaita, v'katan. I mean, unfortunately, too many people in leadership have not gone to psychologists, and they should have, and we'd be a much better community for it, right? So talk to me about this stigma, and is there any way to address it?
Again, a lot of this goes back to the Shidduch crisis, supply and demand, you understand? And that's what puts everybody at a disadvantage. So anything that's an eyebrow raiser or that's chas v'shalom not in the norm is automatically stigmatized. I mean, that's just the way it's going to be. And therefore, when someone goes to a psychologist, people are just like, what do I need, you know, what do I need that for? You know what I mean?
Why you know what you need it for? Because the person is very self-aware, and they're trying to fix something rather than brush it under the rug. And they've probably come to they're enlightened. They understand conflict. They understand, whereas the other person is probably a good person to learn the daf yomi or to make a potato kugel. Maybe that's why.
Listen, I can't say you're not right, but again, me and you are not going to change the stigmas that are out there. And you're right. Probably everybody should be seeing a psychologist. But that's unfortunately not the world that we live in today in this, you know, insulated community. And again, everything is a mehechatesi concept, you know, like why should I go there when I can go elsewhere? You know, I have so many options, you know? So ultimately,
Rabbi Friedman, I would just say it comes back to like, you know, the top boy and the top girl, and they made, you know, 10 potato kugels. That's what they made together. Well, maybe if they had an element of awareness, doesn't it show somebody who's trying to grow, somebody who's addressing, somebody who's curious? Like, yeah, if we want to just go with the status quo, your children will be status quo. If you want to go with the bland and the boring, and you will have bland and boring children, and you will have a bland and boring life.
I hear you.
I mean, just look at the great business leaders of our generation, right? I mean, Jeff Bezos, I mean, he first of all, he looks like the Satan himself, right? I mean, this pointy-headed, bald guy with the strangest, but he's changed the world, and the things he says, and he'll talk about his coaches, and his, I mean, if you want to move mountains, if you want to make a difference, you're going to have to encounter stresses in life. So I would think it would be something that is embraced as self-awareness, as growth, rather than being seen as something that's, yeah. It's a very, you know, antediluvian sort of anachronistic attitude, no? Am I being too simplistic?
No, you're not being simplistic at all. I mean, ultimately what you're saying is correct and goes back to the point where, you know, just because someone is a top guy on what we call the shidduch market doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be a top guy in life. And usually the guys that, you know, are very, very, very successful in any area are not necessarily considered the top guys because they, you know, they come with flavor, and anybody that has flavor is automatically an eyebrow raiser. You know, anybody who's who you know, again, like business leaders, they're not the biggest Bali Midas. They're not the, they're usually a shark. They're you know, they're smarter. They're, you know, three steps ahead, and that doesn't necessarily make for the best shidduch prospect. So you're right. People have to try to find. I tell this to people all the time. You know, find the diamond in the rough. Find the guy who, you know. You're right. Today, maybe he's, you know, he's not such a conformist, and he's a little bit more of a mechutzif, and, you know, he doesn't necessarily, he goes to the beat of his own drum, and he doesn't just follow the sheep to the slaughterhouse, but look for a guy who could be his own person, and who could be, you know, who can be creative, and, you know, the most creative minds of our society are people that would be undesirable in the shidduch market. You know that.
You're saying the Kol Avraham Avinu, who was Kol Olam Me'ever Echad, Mehuva Ever Hasheni, would have had a real problem getting a top girl today.
I don't know. But I'll tell you this much. If you're blah, blah, then you're fine, you know? All you have to do is just never make a peep, never make a sound, be a goody-two-shoes, and you'll be fine into the thing. You know? That's the best shidduch recipe. Don't do anything extraordinary. Don't do anything crazy. Just say blah. And you'll be fine.
Rabbi Freeman, Rabbi Yisrael Freddy Freeman, thank you for your time. It was wonderful, enlightening speaking to you.
Thank you. We'll be in touch.
Also, my good sir. Bye-bye.
Okay.
So this wraps up our two-week segment on mental health, which I think is so important for us as Yidin, because what are we? We're the Am HaSefer, Am Navoin V'Chacham. If we would be football players or basketball players, athletes, it wouldn't be very important, mental health. But just as important as a trainer, a physical trainer, and a gym, and a set of barbells, and a running track, great facilities are important to the boxer, to the etc., so too is the mental gym, clearing up our disabilities so that we could be Am Navin V'Chacham to the Am HaNifchar, the Am HaSefer, the Am that is Kulei Sichli, the Kol Kol Yaakov. And just as we use modern methods for medicine, we use, you know, cholesterol medication, aspirin, allergy medication, allergy shots, etc., so why don't we make use of the new breakthroughs, medical breakthroughs, on mental health? So we discussed reversing the stigma. We spoke about how many Rosh Hashivas, Chachamim, etc., use mental health professionals so that they could be at peak performance. We spoke about it from a shidduch-based level. We spoke about what type of, how to interview a therapist, what type of professionals. Can you get somebody who is just, you know, he says, look, I'm a really smart guy. I can do this, you know. We've had scandals, unfortunately, in our community, and these people have molested, caused great harm. Or do we go to somebody who actually has a shimush or a degree? And then we spoke about OCD. We spoke about pikuach nefesh. So that's the roundup. I hope you enjoy it. Wishing you all the best. This is David Lichtenstein from the Yeshiva Shel Maila. I look forward to speaking to you next week.